This is a HeadGum Original.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
And I have levels, and here I am. Hello.
Hello.
I don't even know how you got me on this show, Connor. I'm honored to be here, but you hit me at the right time at a moment when I said, sure, and now here we are. You interrupt me at any time, but I'll just keep talking about
this. This is Zach Braff, star of the TV series Scrubs, writer, director, star of the movie Garden State, but also, less notably, another actor who was rejected by Band of Brothers.
Well, you know, it's funny. You opened up an old wound with this podcast because, you know, it's one of those, every once in a while in Hollywood, a job comes along that's huge like this. And this was a very high profile thing. I was just starting out. Everybody I knew who was an actor was going in for it. And I got a call back. Now, when I was first starting out, I didn't get a time. I mean, we get little nibbles here and there, but to get a call back for a Tom Hanks produced epic miniseries was a big deal. And I remember, that's why it's so ingrained in my memory.
There are roughly 500 speaking roles in Band of Brothers, a lot of them played by actors who went on to become big stars. James McAvoy, Simon Pegg, Tom Hardy, Michael Fassbender, to name a few. But there are also a lot of actors who auditioned and did not get cast. Seth Rogen was one. We talked to him back in season one. He didn't even get a call back. Zach, however, came a lot closer to landing a pretty significant role, as did two other actors I spoke with. They were all rejected, but eventually each of them went on to star in major TV shows. However, it should be noted that none of them were told that they had dead eyes.
I love it. I mean, the only thing I could say on his behalf on that is like, what attention to detail. How many lines was it? Like two sentences?
It was less. It at the time, I think it was maybe four lines, and it got cut down to two by the time it was on the air.
Okay, so two sentences. And this man is going back and going, you know what? There's something about the eyes that aren't right for this two-sentence character.
This is Dead Eyes, a podcast about one actor's quest to find out why Tom Hanks fired him from a small role in the 2001 HBO miniseries Band of Brothers.
My name is Connor Ratliff. I'm an actor and comedian. 22 years ago, I was fired by Tom Hanks. The reason, I was told at the time, he had looked at my audition tape and he thought that I had dead eyes.
He's probably got 500 characters to cast in the miniseries, and he's going, hold the door, hold the door. The eyes aren't right for this two-sentence character. That is some micromanagement there.
And that's the short version. So, each of the stories you're going to hear today begins the same way. Guy walks into an audition room to see a shockingly thin Castaway-era Tom Hanks.
I think I remember there being like 10 people in the room. And in the corner, behind the door, was Tom Hanks. And he had the full beard, mega beard. And he's like, well, how do you like L.A.? And I just come from Manhattan, and I was, you know, I was young, and I had been partying a lot in Manhattan and going out late. And one of the adjustments to coming to L.A. was that everything closes at 2 in the morning, and it isn't sort of an all-night city like Manhattan. And for some reason, I thought that would be a part of my small talk. And I remember saying, everybody goes to bed so early here, or something. And the room laughed, and he said, well, we work, Zach. We have jobs. Something like that, he said. And then I went into the audition, and I felt really confident because I really had memorized it. And the lines were something like, he's a super cocky young sergeant or someone who's higher up than the people he's talking to. And he's making someone cook, or he's going to make them cook. And it's something, this is all I remember this many fucking years later. It's something like, I like spaghetti. That's all I really remember. And I think I did a really good job because I remember Tom Hanks being like, I remember feeling that I had kind of kicked ass in the room.
Which is a great feeling, but a dangerous feeling because you're getting your hopes up.
Yeah, but as actors, we all know there is a lot of relief when you walk out of the room and go, okay, now it's totally in someone else's hands, but I did what I wanted to do. I got some laughs, I got some smiles, I can tell I did a good job. Now it's up to the universe, and I don't know, for all I know, they'll cast a celebrity, which is what they did. They ended up casting David Schwimmer.
Have you ever talked to David Schwimmer about that?
No, I know him a little bit. I mean, I haven't seen him in years, but I know him as an acquaintance, and he's an awesome guy. I don't think that ever came up. Like, hey, man, you got Band of Brothers. I didn't. Does Schwimmer say the word spaghetti? Am I remembering correctly?
David Schwimmer does say the word spaghetti. It's actually a significant plot point in the first episode.
I think a special meal before their afternoon off would be a welcome change of pace. Would you agree?
Yes, sir.
I like spaghetti.
Back in March 2020, right at the start of the pandemic, Zach tweeted out a request for TV show binge watch recommendations with the caveat, not Scrubs. Seen it? Lived it. When one of his followers suggested Band of Brothers, he replied, "Trivia. I auditioned for this and didn't get it. I've been pouting for decades. Might be time to watch." 16 days later, he began a Scrubs rewatch podcast with co-star Donald Faison. My conversation with Zach took place over a year after that, so Band of Brothers?
I should confess that I never watched it. I think this being on this podcast is making me look at it and say it probably was still to this day related to not getting it because I have this sort of PTSD about it. Yeah, it's so petty, but I think it's part of being an actor. I have no idea if it's good. Is it good?
I think it's good. Yeah. I mean, it's not like you can't even sample Band of Brothers to see if you like it because the first episode is that you have to start. You have to start from the place that hurts, you know? In a lot of reviews, people would actually criticize that first episode, starting out Band of Brothers with like a celebrity who has like, the audience has like an impression of them.
I understand that critique. I mean, that's something, by the way, and that's something that I face because when you've the negative to being to having the luck of being on a show for 9-10 years is that people know you so specifically as a thing.
Now, does that also somewhat take it out of your hands in the because at that point you weren't the star of a TV show, you were complete unknown.
I was a waiter, yeah.
If they cast a big star, it's not like if they cast another unknown where it feels like it could have been more of a coin toss, you know?
That's a good point. I think when you lose a job out to someone who's famous, you go, oh, which happens in this town every second. I mean, they're often trying to get a celebrity and then they have time to kill while they wait for the celebrity to say yes or no. So they go, oh, well, let's read people. And so they read people, but then the celebrity's like, okay. And then all that time and blood, sweat, and tears by the poor actors who spent the week memorizing it and running it with their roommates and their parents and at stoplights and at the gas station was all wasted time. Although that's a pretty negative, pessimistic, cynical way to look at it. I guess the other way is that each time you go out, you get better and you gain skill points.
Timeline-wise, it wasn't that long after your Band of Brothers experience before Scrubs started. So it's possible that if you had gotten Band of Brothers, you might not have gotten Scrubs.
I'll tell you an even better one. I was very lost right before Scrubs, and my New York agents gave me a call and said, hey, there's a new Edward Albee play, and it's very weird, and it's very surreal, and it involves not only nudity, but full frontal nudity, but also your character simulates receiving a blowjob while naked on stage. And I'm just like thinking like my grandma coming to this, I'm thinking of like my parents, and my parents are so supportive. They would have been there 8 shows a week. So I fly to New York because I'm like, you know what? It's Edward Albee. I mean, I would originate a role in an Edward Albee play. I mean, how cool would that be? And I was sort of desperate. I think in hindsight, I was sort of desperate. I was like clutching at straws. And I didn't like the play at all. It was very surreal. And I didn't understand it. It's called The Play About the Baby, if you happen to be someone who's so intrigued by this that you really want to read it. I go to New York. I go into audition. I don't even get a callback. I didn't even get like, do it again. I get like, thanks. That sort of spiraled me. I was like, I flew all the way fucking here for a play I don't want to do because I was homesick from Manhattan. And what am I doing? Spiraling. Had I gotten that fucking play, doing 8 shows a week, naked, getting fake blowjobs, I would not have been available to audition for Scrubs.
Wow.
I think about that all the time.
There's no doubt it would have set you on a very different path.
Well, I don't know that I couldn't have gotten a show eventually, but you know, getting a 9-year run on a TV show is kind of like a lot akin to winning the lottery. And the fact that my number came up, it doesn't matter if you're good. There's so many talented people out here that don't have their number come up. They're journeyman actor and actresses, but I'm very aware that I had a lottery win moment, and to win that moment, you got to be in the right place at the right time. Whereas the play about the baby, I would have been lubing up my body 8 shows a week.
Speaking of numbers coming up next, the star of the TV show Numbers.
I'm someone who watched every episode of Num3ers, and I'll call it Num3ers because that shows you I'm a fan.
Fuck you.
Because I understand how to pronounce it.
Fuck you.
You don't like that I called it that?
No, it's fine.
Band of Brothers Reject number 2. David Krumholtz.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Hey, can I get a bacon sandwich, please?
Bacon sandwich?
Yeah, actually.
This is a clip from our season 1 finale, the Private Zelensky fan fiction scene I wrote, and that is actor David Krumholtz playing the role of the army cook.
Whoa, hey, what happened to your eyes?
What?
They look terrible.
Okay, you know what? Go ahead and make it 2 bacon sandwiches.
2 bacon sandwiches coming right up.
I'll be right back. I'm gonna get in the car.
I had never met David before I asked him to do that weird cameo as a character who does not exist in the HBO miniseries.
I think that's when I found out that you had a Band of Brothers audition story.
I have a pretty crazy one.
David was the star of the hit TV procedural Numbers, which ran for 6 seasons, 118 episodes on CBS from 2005 to 2010. But you might know him from The Santa Claus 1 and 2 or HBO's The Deuce, movies by the Coen brothers. He has what I consider to be an enviably impressive IMDb.
You and I almost met a few years back. You did monologues for ASCAT at UCB, and it just happened to be a week that I wasn't there. I was very bummed about it because I've been a big fan of your work for a long time.
Well, thank you, but I'm incredibly unimpressive in person.
Well,
to this day, if I go to any kind of industry function, most people assume I'm an agent's assistant.
And I should note that since this conversation was recorded, I did finally get to meet David in person when he did monologues recently for the improv show Rat Scraps in New York City. We talked at length about how he is the lead singer in not one, but 2 Grateful Dead tribute bands. At the time of his Band of Brothers audition, David had been a working actor for 7 years. He already had a couple of seasons of television work under his belt, plus a handful of feature film credits, in addition to guest spots on shows like Freaks and Geeks, Law and Order, and ER, by the time he found himself in a room with Tom Hanks and his mega beard.
He had the big beard, yeah. And he was crazy nice. And I did well enough that they invited me to the mix and match session.
And what does mix and match entail?
A mix and match session is essentially where you go in with 30 other people who all have two or three roles to memorize. And instead of auditioning by yourself, you go in with them. These were conversations between 5-6 people. So why not bring 5-6 actors in at one time? D.B. Sweeney was there, and Henry Thomas, and Kevin Corrigan, and Donnie Wahlberg. But there were another, like, 30 actors there. And yeah, it was super awkward in the sense that you might be going in to audition for a character alongside an actor who is also going to audition for that same character in a different session. So they're going to call you in more than once, essentially. And Spielberg was there, and Tony Toe, and Tom Hanks, and Meg Lieberman. So I go in, and it's me and 4 other actors, and there's Steven Spielberg at the back of the room. And, you know, I got very nervous. And this was a problem for me at that time. I was getting very, very visibly nervous at auditions, you know, like trembling nervous. But regardless, we went for it, and we started doing the scene. We did it once, and they asked us to do it again with some notes. And we started the second take of it, and Steven Spielberg walked over to the camera, which was filming on the tripod, and removed the camera from the tripod. And I was on one end of these 4 or 5 guys. And Spielberg just literally took the camera, walked over, and put it in my face in the middle of the scene. Whatever, I rocked it. It was fine. It didn't faze me. At least I thought it didn't faze me. And then he went down the line and filmed all the other actors doing the scene.
Yeah.
Did my thing, cool experience. They let us out of the room, and I knew I was going to get called in again for another character. So they're calling in 5 at a time. Everyone, so it's like this revolving door of actors coming in and out and back in. And you're there for hours. It was a 4-hour audition. And I come out, and maybe 20 minutes later, Meg Lieberman comes out and says, "Can I, David Krumholz, can I speak to you?" And I'm like, oh. You know, like when you're at an audition and someone calls your name out for, and you think, oh, I fucking got it.
Yeah.
Got the shit. She's about to tell me, like, don't tell anybody, but you're in. You know, like, this is going to be great, you know? And I go up to her, and she goes, "They love you." And I'm like, oh, my God. And she goes, "But there's a problem." And I go, "What?" She goes, "You're too nervous." She tells me I'm too nervous, which in turn makes me about 1,000 times more nervous, right?
Yeah.
Like, it's the kind of the worst thing you could say, but I understand what she was saying, and it was very compassionate of her to say, like, you need to calm down, dude. Don't they understand who they are and why that would make me nervous?
Yeah.
Anyway. So then she, about 20 minutes later, she comes out and tells a new group, which I'm included in, that we're next. So we're going back. I'm going back in. And I'm like, oh, my God. I'm so nervous.
Yeah.
So they call us in, and I'm just like, dude, fake it till you make it. You are nervous. There's no way to combat your nervousness, but just pretend like you're not. And I thought, I can do this. I can totally do this. I walk in the door, standing right there is Spielberg, and he's introducing himself to everyone. You know, "Hey, I'm Steven. What's your name?" You know, he comes up to me and he goes, "Hey, how are you? We've met before." Now, I know I have never met Steven Spielberg.
Right.
I obviously know that.
You would know. You'd be the one who would
know. Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. And he was like, "We've met before." And I said, no, we haven't. And he said, "Yes, we have." And the right thing to do in that moment is to go, "Yes, we have. You are right, sir. And please, you know." But I argued with him and I said, "No, I've never met you. And it's amazing to meet you." And he looked at me and he said, we've met before, and walked away.
Oh.
So now I'm a mess. I've just interacted with Steven Spielberg, and it didn't go well, you know?
You've had a disagreement with him.
I've had a disagreement, that's right. So it becomes Nightmare City, and then we do it, and I fuck up my lines. Like, there's no response from them. It's a disaster. It's a disaster. So that was the end of that day, and I was very upset. I was very depressed, and I was mind blown. And I started thinking, like, who does he think I am that he thinks he's met me before? Like, does he think I'm the sort of Italian-looking kid from Hook? Like, who does he think I am, you know? Of course, I called my agents, and I said, I don't know if I did the right thing, but I argued with them.
Did you go through the filmography of Spielberg to see if there's anybody that he could, like, beyond the guy in Hook? Like, is there anybody?
Well, so that kid is Jimmy Matteo, and you know, we look somewhat alike, but no, I can't imagine who the hell he thinks I am. And to this day, I have no idea.
James Matteo actually was cast in Band of Brothers, so this could explain the confusion. Both of them were in the mix, and they look alike. But I have another theory.
Here's my thought.
Okay.
And this is making certain assumptions.
Now, mind you, this is pre-Oscar Isaac, pre-Jake Johnson. We're talking the year 1999 or 2000. They weren't really around, so it couldn't have been either of those doppelgangers.
But you had worked on a Steven Spielberg production.
No.
ER.
Oh, I guess so. I guess, yeah, that is a Steven.
But here's the thing. Like, the episode that you are in is one of the iconic episodes of the show.
Yeah, you know, it was February sweeps, and I remember it being very highly rated. Like, it broke a record for them or something. I mean, You stabbed
Noah Wiley.
Noah Wiley, one of the major characters, and I killed Kelly Martin. So it was a big deal.
The episode, entitled Be Still My Heart, aired on February 10th, 2000. Which means that if Spielberg had been keeping up with the smash hit show he was producing, he might have seen David's acting very close to the time of those callbacks. And in case you think I'm exaggerating what a significant impression it made, in 2018, Entertainment Weekly published an oral history of that single hour of ER. To put that in perspective, that's a fairly recent article about an episode from a series that ran for 331 episodes.
I'm not saying I should have won the Emmy. I'm saying a little bit of consideration would have went a long way.
Even just a little more buzz, right?
Yeah, maybe a phone call from someone. Maybe, you know, a phone call from Spielberg.
I think there is a strong chance, and this is just me speculating, that Spielberg, I don't know how heavily involved he was in any of the day-to-day operations of that show, but I bet Spielberg not only saw that episode, but was affected by it. Because I've had the experience of meeting someone that I've listened to their podcast and I feel like I know them, or
right.
Meeting someone that I've seen perform and I realize I start talking to them in a too familiar fashion. And then I realize, wait, you've never met me. I've met you.
Right.
I wonder if Spielberg remembered you from that episode and it was such a vivid experience that he was certain, oh, I've met this guy before.
Maybe. I mean, and then my response to that would be, you know, Steven, get your shit together. You know what I mean? Like, you're going to fanboy all over me, which is essentially what he was doing. If he did watch ER, that it's a bit much. And so, you know, I mean, you know, take the picture with the guy, you know, charge him $80. I could have done all that.
I think there's a good chance. I'd be willing to bet not a lot of money, but I'd be willing to bet a little bit of money that was what he remembered you from.
How would we ever know?
I mean, let's say Steve hears about this episode.
Yeah.
It comes back to me and thinks, oh my goodness, of course I hadn't met him. But I felt like I knew him because I'd engaged with him as an actor, as a producer. As a producer of the show, I felt as though, is there any chance he was around when that episode was filmed?
No.
He might have visited the set incognito.
No.
I don't know. You wouldn't know, though. You wouldn't know.
I'm told he's not allowed on the Warner Brothers lot. There was an incident. But no, no, he wasn't there. So check this out. So about 5 years later, I get invited to a Golden Globes after party, and it's my first and only one that I've ever been invited to, and it's the good one. It's like the one that like a lot of people show up to. I'm in a suit. I look great. Jack Nicholson is there. It's crazy. And Spielberg is nominated for Munich, and he walks in the room, and I'm sort of adjacent to him when he walks in, and he's having a conversation with a few people, and I'm with my girlfriend, who's my wife now, and we're talking, and at one point I look over at him, and he looks over at me, and we make eye contact, and he waves, and I go, hey, and he comes over, and I'm like, hey, how's it going? And we have a whole long talk about Munich, and I'm expressive. I'm clear in what I'm saying, you know, I'm using heavy verbiage to try to impress him, and it's going really well.
Yeah.
Now, you know, when you're nervous, you mean to say one thing and the other thing comes out. So we talk and it's wrapping up and he says, all right, well, great seeing you. And instead of saying nice seeing you, I said, nice meeting you by accident. I said, yeah, nice meeting you. And now he's like, there's something wrong with this person. I can see it in his eyes. He's looking at me like, you're a moron.
Yeah, and you've now discredited the previous, like when you said we haven't met before.
Right, right.
You've now given him ammunition in his mind for like, he never knows when we've met.
He doesn't give a shit about me is what he's thinking.
Oh.
And you know, that this whole Munich shit, that with this whole conversation, who knows if he'll remember it? And how many times do I have to meet this guy before he understands that I've met him several times? That's what's going on in his mind. And in my mind, all I hear is like a flat line. My mind stops working in this moment. And, my ears may have bled a bit. It was bad. And to this day, and to be honest with you, I'm so glad we're doing this right now, because on the off chance that he may see it, I'm explaining myself that I'm aware, self-aware, and I knew what was happening in the situation in the moment, and I apologize. That's it.
Have you met him since then?
No. Ed Burns told me he wants nothing to do with me.
For real?
No, I'm kidding.
I do think it's a small chance, but I do think there's a chance that Steven Spielberg hears about our conversation. And I'd like to think it's the smallest chance, but it's not impossible. It's not outside the realm of possibility. Someone could listen to it and they tell a friend and they tell a friend and then someone says, "Oh, you should really hear this."
Right.
I like to imagine that there's a world in which you don't just meet him on these two occasions and have these awkward interactions, because he's a filmmaker who, he's not trying to remake films he's made previously. He consistently is trying to make films he hasn't made before.
It's just something that I feel like he is doing consciously, which is showing his range as a director. To this day, trying to push himself out of his comfort zone. He doesn't have to do that. He could make 1,000, you know, ETs and people would be happy, but he's still an artist. You know, that's what I love about his work.
Here's my pitch.
Mm-hmm.
If he truly is, and I agree with you, an artist who is looking to get outside of his comfort zone, what fits that description more than choosing to work with an actor that he has met, in, by his estimation, 3 times, and been denied by you twice? What could be more uncomfortable than that?
Yes, what can come from that?
This is a director-actor collaboration that absolutely must happen, I feel. But are you willing, is there anything you wouldn't do for Steven Spielberg? Is there any, we'll get it out of the way, are there any kind of films you wouldn't do for Steven Spielberg?
Are you crazy?
So you're completely open. This is a gift. This is an amazing offer that you're putting out there to him.
I would do anything. Yes, of course.
All right.
There are certain people you just, you do anything for.
Yeah. Well, I really do hope it'll happen.
Thanks, Connor. I appreciate it. And I feel similarly. I hope it happens for you too, man.
I mean, we'll see.
You never know.
You never know.
You never, ever know.
When we return, Band of Brothers Reject Numb 3 or 3.
Fuck you.
Adam Scott.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. Conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
So is it that my voice sounds painful? Is it an abrasive sound you're getting? Is there something I can do?
I don't want you to like get down on yourself about it or be self-conscious because your voice is lovely.
This is Adam Scott from Step Brothers, Party Down, Parks and Recreation, and Big Little Lies.
No, I just didn't know, like, if it would be better if I talked a different way or something for the purposes of your headphones.
No. It's fine. It's a little loud, but...
Is this any better? Does that sound any better?
Yeah.
All right, so that's better. I've done something that
that's
helps
great.
A little.
Yeah.
Great.
He has a new series on Apple TV Plus called Severance, which co-stars my friend and past guest, Zach Cherry, who told me that Adam was a fan of this podcast, and more importantly, that he had a Band of Brothers audition experience.
It was either... The reason I think it was probably January 2000 is because I was working on this little indie called Seven and a Match right up until like Christmas break. One of the other actors in that indie, Ian Bailey, is the one who ended up getting the role that I was auditioning for.
By this point, Adam already had a really solid resume of 90s acting work. Shows like Boy Meets World, Party of Five, NYPD Blue. He's even in a Star Trek movie.
Sir, there's another starship coming in. It's the Enterprise.
And, like David Krumholtz, he had already been on an episode of ER. His Band of Brothers audition story, of course, begins in the same room in Los Angeles with a bearded, super skinny Tom Hanks.
He was kind of tucked into a corner with a chair and a coffee table sort of in front of him, so you could not get to him. I remember thinking, oh, that's really smart that they're doing this, because everyone is going to want to touch Tom Hanks. Everyone's going to want to shake his hand when they walk into the room and talk to him. But he wasn't standoffish. He was super friendly across that bridge of objects in the room.
How did you feel that first audition went with Tom Hanks? Like, what was your vibe on your own, how you'd done?
I remember feeling like it went as well as I thought it could, considering how nervous I was. Really, really nervous. And early on, I tended to get lots of roles for nervous characters because those are the auditions that I could score on, because I have a hard time kind of masking anxiety or, you know, nervousness or whatever. I probably overestimated how well I did just because I was so relieved that it was over. But then I remember running into Ian and just all of a sudden my bubble being popped, like, wait, I'm not the only one auditioning for this? Like, this isn't already my job? How can that be? You have to trick yourself into feeling all these things and thinking all these things in order to keep going. And running into Ian, I sort of knew I was doomed. And then that was confirmed for me a few weeks later.
And was there a callback or was that it?
No, that was it. And I don't know if they had another round. I remember feeling like the vibe was, this is the audition. Like, you'll either get it or you won't. But maybe they did have more auditions after that. I have no idea.
I talked to David Krumholtz, and he said there was a point where they were doing mix and match auditions where they'd like bring in a group of people and see like, how does this group of actors look? I never know whether or not that's the next phase of process or that's the way they're like rooting through a general crowd of people, you know?
I would imagine that would be like the next step after what I did. So I didn't even make it that far, but I was treating it and the time afterwards as if I was waiting to hear if I got it or not, not if I was going to continue auditioning for it. So hearing that now even like makes me feel like shit. You know how that
it
just never stops. No, yeah. not at all. But it just never stops. And it's like 22 years later. And I'm like, oh man, I didn't even make it past Tom Hanks. But it's not surprising to me, of course.
Eight years after failing to make it past the Tom Hanks round of Band of Brothers auditions, Adam did end up getting cast in a Playtone production. The Great Buck Howard, starring Colin Hanks, John Malkovich, and Emily Blunt. Tom Hanks also has a small role in the movie, but Adam didn't get a chance to reconnect with him until the movie premiered.
It was at Sundance, like, you know, a year and a half later or something. He introduced everyone out onto the stage, one by one. And that was a big deal to be, you know, introduced by Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
And I had a tiny role in the movie. Why I was even there is a mystery. And it was also cool to see him because he was like the producer of the movie and his son was the star and he was like the MC before the movie started. And backstage he was, you know, saying hello to everyone. I think he's very aware of who he is, the effect he has on, like great stars are, they can switch it on and be that person for everyone. And it's very Hanksy. It feels like you're in a Tom Hanks movie with him as he's like backstage, like holding court. It was really fun.
A few years later, Adam made a series called The Greatest Event in Television History, where he would produce painstaking shot-for-shot recreations of opening sequences from old TV shows like Simon and Simon, Heart to Heart, and Too Close for Comfort, using actors like Paul Rudd, Katherine Hahn, and my former Ordinary People co-star, John Hamm. For the fourth and final installment, released in 2014, they chose the early 80s Tom Hanks Peter Scolari sitcom Bosom Buddies. Adam cold emailed Playtone to see if there was any chance Hanks might do a brief cameo, not expecting a response. A few days later, he got a yes.
We couldn't believe it, but we just took a camera and a few of us just went to Playtone and they gave us an office to set up in. And then Hanks came down and we did it in like, you know, half an hour and that was it. And he was great.
It's inspiring because it is proof positive that it can be done. Like you can start out with a project that feels like it's a small personal thing. And then it can end up where you can get Tom Hanks to play along if you do it right.
That's right.
Whether or not we're able to stick that landing the way you did, there's a million factors involved in that. But it does give me a warm feeling. Because I had seen it when it aired, but that was years, obviously, before I'd even thought of doing this podcast. And it only occurred to me again when we started corresponding and I realized like, oh, this guy's done it. You know,
he got Tom Hanks to be in his stupid, stupid thing.
Yeah, I got him to play along.
Right.
Was there a point post Band of Brothers where you ever felt like satisfied?
It wasn't until 2010 that I ever was able to really look around and acknowledge any real traction. And it was when I got the job on Parks and Rec. I remember Party Down was ending. We were still shooting it, but it was winding up and it looked like maybe it was gonna ultimately get canceled. We weren't sure. And I was like, you know what? I love this and it's really fun and it's with my friends and I'd rather keep doing this. But for whatever reason, when I just sort of said, I just want to do things that feel good, which sounds kind of Pollyanna-ish or whatever. But that's when weirdly things started to shift. And like a week later, I think that's when kind of Mike called because he was a fan of Party Down. Anyway, I'm not saying there was anything mystical. That's far from it. I'm just saying that I made some choice there and after you're doing this for a certain amount of time, there's a psychological barrier you need to break where you try and do things for yourself and stop chasing the things that you're not particularly fond of. Because when you're starting out, you spend so much time not even considering if you like something or not, or if this is something you would be into as an audience member. You just want the job, you know?
When you watch Band of Brothers now, how does that work in your system? Like, is there still part of you that thinks like, oh, this would have been great to be in? Or is there a part of you that's like...
First of all, it's so stupid that I never watched it. I mean, it's so good. Remember, my wife was like, don't you want to watch Band of Brothers? And maybe we watched the first one. And I was like, yeah, it's okay. I you know what? Let's watch this. And I just never got around when truly it was because I thought it would be way too painful to watch it. And knowing the reason I never watched it was because I didn't get this role and Ian did get the role. And that's where it started for me. That's why I haven't seen it in 20 years or whatever. It's so dumb. Even now, I was watching it sort of waiting for Ian Bailey's role to sort of emerge, and he rears around and it's, I think it's like episode 4 or 5 that's really kind of centered on him. Mm-hmm. And he's great and he's so much better for the role, but also there's no way I would have been able to do that. 100% they got the right guy for that role, you know?
Even things that you don't hold on to, like you forget about them, it is funny when you think back to certain things and you think what a big deal some things were early in your career that now you're like, oh, what was I worried about? Like it's all the things that were stressful that now seem like, why was I stressed about that?
Totally. I think that I got a super small part in The Aviator a couple years later. And it was the same situation where I knew this thing was coming, where I was going to go audition for Scorsese and Leonardo DiCaprio. And I was so nervous and so certain I was doomed. There was no way it was going to happen. And I remember my wife left me a note on the bathroom mirror, you deserve this. And it sounds stupid now, but it was such a small thing that sort of pushed me to zero in and try to land this thing. And it took a while, but ultimately I did. And that was sort of something that washed away a lot of this other stuff, the Band of Brothers and 6 Feet Under and all those other things. Even though it was for this small part, it was some sort of validation or something that really kind of kept me afloat for a couple more years at least, you know? Anyway.
I've talked to dozens of people for this podcast, but there is something special for me about talking to other actors who were rejected by Band of Brothers. We always hear about how the people who got cast on that show went through boot camp together and they shared this meaningful experience, and they're always meeting up for reunions. They have this special bond that never ends. Well, our thing doesn't end either, and there are way more of us. So maybe once this pandemic is over, I mean, it's not like we're going to go meet up in Normandy like the real cast does, but maybe all the rejects can go hang out at Venice Beach and get one of those street artists to draw our caricature. That feels about right, doesn't it? Because I think we've reached the point where we can celebrate our shared failure, the one that paved the way for other victories, big ones and the small ones.
And that's been a big part of why your podcast is, why I've connected to it, and why I think, you know, a lot of people have connected. And you've had, you know, Ron on, and you had Colin on, right? Colin Hanks?
Not yet, no.
Oh, I thought you had Colin on.
I mean, I'd love to.
Oh, he would be great.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Oh, my God. He would be great.
So here we are.
Here we are.
Having heard your voice now for months, it's nice to finally put a face to the voice.
Next episode, Colin Hanks.
And that's how you end a fucking podcast.
Yeah, that's it. That's the button.
That's the button.
Ladies and gents, fold your tents, cause we have a winner. Come see a Jane, try to train every devil in her. There's not a man alive who could tame this creature. You better leave the professor behind, see what time will teach her. When we've all collected a spectacular sum, we'll get a little glimpse of the disaster to come. You can just
Dead Eyes is a production of HeadGum Studios. It was created by me, Connor Ratliff. It's written by me, and it's mostly me that you hear talking, including now. The show is produced and edited by Harry Nelson and Mike Comite. Our associate producer is Jordan Allen. Special thanks to my guests, Zach Braff, David Krumholtz, and Adam Scott. Also thanks to Amy Mann for letting us use this song that's playing in the background. It's called Brother's Keeper, and it was a bonus track on her 2012 album, Charmer. If you like Dead Eyes, please do all the things that podcasts tell you to do. Subscribe, rate, review, follow us on Twitter at Dead Eyes Podcast, and talk about us nicely on social media. If you want to reach out, the email is deadeyespodcast@gmail.com. Please tell your friends about this show, especially if you are friends with Tom Hanks, who for two seasons and 37 episodes from 1980 to 1982 starred in the ABC network sitcom Bosom Buddies, alongside the great and talented Peter Scolari, who recently passed away. Scolari was an actor who never stopped doing interesting and surprising work on shows like Newhart and Girls and even the most recent season of Evil. And he never stopped working with Tom Hanks either. He appeared with him on Broadway in the production of Nora Ephron's Lucky Guy. He's also in The Polar Express, From the Earth to the Moon, That Thing You Do, and even one of Tom's first directing gigs, an episode of the Showtime noir anthology series Fallen Angels. And, like David Krumholtz and Adam Scott, Peter also appears in a single episode of the Steven Spielberg-produced TV series ER. He was well-liked and absolutely terrific in everything I ever saw him do. Thanks for listening. Be smart. Stay safe.
Was a HeadGum original.